What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, two writers on their personal experience of mental illness and their message of hope and healing. Horatio Clare is the author of Heavy Light, a journey through madness, mania and healing, in which he recounts his mental breakdown and how he was committed to a locked hospital ward. Alex Riley is a science journalist whose first book is A Cure for Darkness, the story of depression and how we treat it, in which he explains how through his efforts to understand his own depression, he discovered the often surprising history of mental health care over the past 2,000 years. Our speakers sat down together to discuss their expertise and experiences in a recent online event. Let's join them now in conversation.
Welcome, Alex, very much indeed.
Thank you.
Start by asking, perhaps we should both do this, if we might share, as it were. So I'll punt. I identify as somebody who has had a series of breakdowns for what I now realise are explicable reasons. I have a bipolar diagnosis, which I reject and has no handle on me. I am, however, definitely seasonally affective. And I got a very clear and strong set of triggers, which include cannabis, lying, overstress, not enough sleep. And so I need to avoid those things. And the summer is my natural sort of high time, and the winter my natural low. May I ask you about diagnosis, identification, and how you are?
I don't really have a diagnosis. I kind of call it depression, but it's multifaceted. It has, you know, elements of bipolar, and it's recurrent. It kind of comes in waves. It's got some elements of sort of anxiety to it, maybe a bit of autism. I kind of see this as sort of a kind of dimensional view into how, you know, my mental health can take a turn for the worse. So I don't really have a diagnosis. I've kind of been major depressive, but I don't really think that's a label that helps me or even psychiatry. Bipolar, I don't think that's true. I don't have the as hypomanic as I think I would need to have that. And like you, I think it is seasonal, but that could be because of the seasons. But it's also interesting, my mother had depression around Christmas time, so I don't know whether that's some sort of imprint on my own emotional sort of pattern. So yeah, that's why I kind of understand it as this sort of depression with bits added on. And how am I now? I've just gone back onto medication because I was suicidal recently. So yeah, so it's it can spin pretty quickly down. And I've kind of, the triggers can be unknown for me. I don't really know why that I have these sort of periods, but I can manage them with, you know, different approaches, whether it's medication or things that I can do, such as exercise and what I eat and just generally who I see and all these different elements of my life.
That was really interesting when you used, in talking about your mother's sort of Christmas depression, as whether it left a sort of imprint on your pattern of feeling. I must say that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, my father, we would now say, was a sort of a melancholic, rhythmically depressed. It used to link to life events, but it would also come and go. And I'm sure I picked up like some of that almost kind of emotional weather from him. But it's true, isn't it, that the search for biomarkers in depression and mania has proved entirely fruitless Like science can't identify, can't look at somebody and say you're going to be depressed. There isn't a gene for it as far as we know, or at least not one specific to mental illness.
No, I mean, there's no biomarker for any diagnosis in psychiatry. I think that's largely because there isn't one. I think they're all interrelated. I think if you look at the studies in schizophrenia and bipolar, there's a huge amount of overlap in their genetic makeup, but it's not a single gene or a single receptor or a single dopamine neurotransmitter. There are thousands of genes that might, you know, develop a risk factor that are then shaping people towards a certain mental illness or mental disease through their adulthood. So for example, my cousin has schizophrenia, I have depression, and I'm just kind of, I've been fascinated about how our trajectories can be so different with both being a mood disorder and a psychotic disorder, and how our treatments are so widely different. Like I can be at home treated with antidepressants and other medication and psychotherapy, and he spent 5 years in an institution and was, you know, bombarded with pills and injected with all kinds of sedatives. So yeah, I have an interest in the broader sort of patterns in mental illness. And I think once we have that approach, once psychiatry has that, which is, you know, happening now, trying to kind of move away from this very narrow-minded diagnostic approach and seeing them more broadly, I think we'll find biomarkers that could be more related to mental illness, such as, you know, sleep patterns or, you know, behavioral things, emotions, thoughts that we don't really have a grip on right now.
Yes, it does ask serious questions, doesn't it, of psychiatry as a science. Turning to a cure for darkness, can you talk about your thought process going towards the conception and planning of the book? What were you up to? What was your undertaking?
So I wrote an article in 2017 about my experience with mental illness and being a science writer. So I was writing about, like you say, corals and dinosaurs and all these fascinating things. I kind of traveled to rainforest in Puerto Rico to try and find a frog that hadn't been heard for 30 years and that sort of stuff. But I was still kind of taken with these sort of recurrent depressions. And I wrote a piece describing my sort of, you know, how I manage these two elements of my life. And that sort of then got quite a big response and had agents asking me if I wanted to kind of develop the ideas. And eventually it turned into, yeah, this curiosity driven sort of approach to depression. Like what is, you know, where do I stand globally and historically in terms of my family history of depression, rather than just writing a memoir, which is very much, you know, what is my experience and how do these drugs affect me? I wanted to kind of look outwards and sort of take a cross-cultural sort of approach, and then also historical, like what treatments we have forgotten, or which treatments, you know, are coming back into trend, and what can these tell us about the future of psychiatry and mental health care?
So I found the memoir aspects incredibly moving and the cross-cultural ones fascinating. Could you talk about how mental illness or depression have been seen in different cultures and regarded with different approaches?
Yeah, so depression is this sort of like shape-shifting illness. Like we call it depression because we focus on the low mood, you know, a depression in mood. But around the world, that's not the sort of key term that's used. So I traveled to Zimbabwe to sort of meet some of the really sort of grassroots approaches to dealing with the very high burden of mental illness in low-income countries. And depression there wasn't a word for it when the psychiatrists were trying to kind of even just find people who might need basic psychological support. And so they kind of went through, they surveyed people in the community in Harare, the capital city, and found that people were describing it. They just have a different term called kafungisisa, which means thinking too much. So that really kind of gets to the ruminative anxiety element of depression. And so when they had that term, then people could immediately like, oh yeah, you know, I do, you know, have that, or I do struggle with that. And then they can develop treatments to kind of help these people. In India, it's more of a physical, like psychosomatic illness. It's the translation is basically nerves or tension. So you become very tense. And I think there's more of a appreciation for the body rather than just the mind being this sort of separate thing in Indian sort of like Ayurvedic medicine and things like that. So around the world, we have this sort of different terms for the same illness, but people kind of culture sort of focus on one particular element that resonates with their language and how they sort of represent themselves with their bodies.
It made so much sense to me, that thinking too much. That's exactly my experience with depression, was that it wouldn't stop, you know, it wouldn't stop when I tried to sleep. And then you look at you as well as going sideways, as it were, into the different aspects of the world and different cultures, you also look at it chronologically. And I was thinking, you know, if either of us had been, you know, in the anatomy of melancholy, the understanding, the language use, which is absolutely fundamental, it seems to me, and the treatments clearly would have been very different. Would it be fair to ask you to take us on a, in terms of Western medicine, a rough trajectory through the understanding and treatment of what we're calling depression or mental illness?
Sure. So I start with the ancient Greeks, as most people do when you kind of talk anything scientific. You know, the ancient Greeks had something to say, or, you know, written something that's still used today. So ancient Greeks, they thought of depression as being related to a black humor, so a kind of substance in the body, black bile, they called it, which is actually literally translates as melancholy. And they thought this was in excess in different parts of the body. So you could have excess black bile in the brain, and that would cause a particular type of melancholy. You'd have it in your gut, and that would cause a particular type of melancholy. That's, they called it, I think, the gassy disease. I think it was kind of like a lot of flatulence involved, and sort of the gastrointestinal, that sort of constipation that can come with severe depressions. And so that kind of made, that kind of was like the foundation of what came afterwards of, you know, I think it was, for centuries, that basic idea wasn't changed, even when black bile wasn't discovered in the body. So even that this thing wasn't found by some of the greatest anatomists, they still believed that depression was caused by an excess of this thing that doesn't exist. So it was so fixated upon that, yeah, it just kept on going up until, I think, around the 17th, 18th century. But in that time, the treatment for depression was often, you're in the community, or you're sort of, you know, kept by your family, the responsibilities on the family. Then you have certain asylums popping up from about the 13th century onwards. And then that really becomes the way that people are treated in, you know, the Industrial Revolution. A lot of mental illness is sort of burgeoning because of just the work that's going on, a lot of poverty, inequalities, and just the general sort of work that's involved, a lot of death, people kind of suffering from grief. So these asylums pop up, and the first ones are kind of like, they're quite positive. You know, this, you know, people go in and have this support that they need from people who are trained to kind of look after them and just have this basic sort of care away from their stresses of life. But asylums then become so successful that they just become overburdened, and they have thousands of inpatients who just have no care. They're just abandoned or chained in some elements. And so, yeah, the asylum was kind of where you would probably go if you had, you know, a severe depression or, you know, bipolar, or you would be treated within your family, and it wouldn't be spoken about. And then, as I kind of write in the book, the 20th century, late 19th centuries, and when we have, you know, a lot of the different approaches that become lobotomies or ECT, followed by antidepressants, and then all the psychotherapies sort of emerge in the 1950s, 1960s. And all of these have like sort of lessons for today, is what I kind of like took away from this sort of broader approach to depression.
What you're saying is so resonant. I mean, so what happened to me was I had a full-on psychotic breakdown at the end of 2018, and it moved from hypomania, which you will know, but perhaps not everybody, is sort of racing mood and elevated thoughts and optimism and sort of fast speech and hypersexuality and a kind of inflated ego, through to mania, which is the same thing but worse, and into full-on psychosis, which sounds, I mean, before I had it, I would have thought that psychosis meant you went around sort of cutting people up or something. But in fact, I lived in a parallel world in which people were all part of a huge and fairly benign conspiracy of which I was a sort of prime mover, although in the background, and that I had to complete ritualistic tasks. It could be arranging cigarette butts or listening to Today in Parliament or getting stoned when John Bercow spoke in order to help influence the outcome of Brexit, which I regret failing at quite so comprehensively, although you will admit I did hold it off for a little while, to the point where I ran my car off the road for what seemed like very good reasons, and it was all to do with MI6 and aliens. And these things were entirely real to me. Started as a game, as a child's fantasy, and then the fantasy just took over. And finally, my beloved ex and friends were able to get me properly assessed. I talked my way out of mental hospital the first time I was there, but the second time, and somebody called an AMP, which is an approved mental health professional, who's a social worker, for anybody watching or listening, who covers your area and can be found and contacted with a bit of diligence, and they give you an assessment along with two doctors. And I had the doctors fooled, but not the social worker, thankfully. And so she sectioned me, although they don't like to use that vocabulary. They use detained. And I was taken to a hospital in Wakefield under Section 2 of the Mental Health Act, which is a phenomenally powerful piece of legislation. I basically then, all of my rights were dependent on my responsible clinician, who was a psychiatrist. And there I was given two doses of quetiapine or quetiapine. I'm never sure of the pronunciation because I'm dyslexic. And that drained the madness out of me in about 60 hours. They said you presented as sane in 60 hours. And I was there for about 2 weeks. And they released me back into the community after sort of you do trial runs home and back to make sure you can and you're willing to. And, you know, they said, you really, if you want to get out, you need to take these pills. And they gave me a choice of lithium, sodium valproate or aripiprazole. And I was made to make the decision, which struck me as weird then and outrageous later. And then honest, it turns out, because, of course, no psychiatrist knows exactly how their pills work. As the one who wasn't responsible for me admitted, and the one who therefore had the most time to give me. But I was very cowardly, and to those people taking medication, I admire you, and in no way advocate coming off by yourself. But I was scared of it, and I was unsettled by the fact the psychiatrists couldn't really explain how they worked. And I felt that I hadn't been given any assessment time by those doctors, 15 minutes. I thought a psychiatrist was somebody like Anthony Clare, you know, on the radio when I was a kid, who actually asked you questions for an hour or so. But no. And so I started digging, and I came to the conclusion that I was seasonally affective, cannabis psychotic, and in dire need of proper therapy. And the hardest line in my book is between those who can afford therapy and those who can't, those who can afford to jump the queue. And I got a loan off my dad, a gift, and he paid for 10 sessions. And I was dead lucky in that Rebecca found a wonderful therapist, and we did EMDR, which changed my life, along with a lot of behavioral and circumstantial and familial changes. And so although the science says that I should have had another breakdown in 3 years since, I haven't. I haven't even been remotely close to... I've been sort of high mood, definitely elevated mood, and definitely low mood, but none of it seems mysterious to me. My triggers seem to be clear. So that's where I am. And the second half of Heavy Light is an investigation into what exactly was going on, how we treat it, what psychiatry knows and doesn't know. And I found it eye-opening and outraging. You spoke really interestingly, in one of your interviews, somebody asks you about the kind of the role of anger and how you felt. And you said that you did feel angry about the mechanisms of diagnosis and prescription and overprescription, but that you also felt that anger wouldn't help anybody. Can you talk about your relationship with those things?
Well, my relationship is I'm constantly coming on and off medication because, you know, it's... something I don't want to be on, but unfortunately that's the one thing that I think is allowing me to be stable and to be safe. You mentioned, you know, your partner was worried about you and, you know, helps get you sectioned. On my side, I'm not manic, but I'm suicidal, and she's terrified when I go out the door, because she's just expecting that call that, you know, that I've done it. And so she's, you know, been very close to making that same call. And So for me, yeah, I completely agree with you. I don't think we know much about these drugs. I've been offered lithium just as you did. And, you know, we have very different experiences. But I do find that antidepressants, different types of them, allow me to live a semi-functional life. Yeah, someone asked me on a previous podcast, it's like, which one, if you took away, would you feel, you know, the most, the loss most? And it would be, yeah, my medication. Psychotherapy, I think, I would say that psychotherapy is essential for understanding and, you know, digging up some things that might be related to the triggers. But unfortunately for me, I think the medication is something that I have to rely on, because those traumas and those sort of past experiences are just perhaps, and maybe I'm not there yet as well. Like I'm 31. I might, you know, find that with extended psychotherapy, I come off medication. That is my hope. But yeah, I think we do. What worries me is I think we do perhaps not over prescribe, but we give these drugs away so willingly. And they do come with real side effects. They do, you know, it's very difficult to come off them sometimes. I've come off them 3 times. And the first time it was the most difficult, and I did it over 3 months, and it still was like stepping back into depression for a while. The second time I did it quicker and it actually worked out pretty well. But, you know, there is that risk that you might not be able to come off them for a very long time. And so for doctors just to give away something that's a very powerful psychoactive drug, just because someone's got maybe kind of like a mild depression or anxiety, I think that's absolutely like, yeah, it should be more of a, let's try these options first. And then if these don't work, like we have, you know, psychotherapy, which we're not providing enough. People get maybe 6 sessions of CBT in 8 months. Like that's criminal. And maybe, you know, integrating something like exercise, diet, mindfulness, these sort of apps that might be more useful for people's mental health. And if all those things fail and you're still depressed, then yes, I think, you know, medication might be something. And if you're in a critical position and you can't function, then yes. But I think those steps aren't being taken, whereas just go to a GP, they give you a pill, and you might be stuck on that pill for 2 years.
I think it's so brave, because of course, you know, I know in theory people taking medication, and, you know, I have, but to actually talk to somebody who has your depth of understanding and involvement with it, I mean, it's absolutely mighty. I was frightened of aripiprazole. I didn't like the side effects. I mean, I agreed to take it just to get out of the hospital. And then Rebecca's feeling was that if I didn't continue to take it, you know, she was going to just end it. And we didn't want to break up that way. And so I lied about taking aripiprazole for a long time, because I knew I was fine. And I was fine. But, you know, it's all very well. And so it wasn't until I had a conversation with Yasmin Ishak, who runs an open dialogue service. And she said, you know, I said, what would you do, Yasmin, though? Supposing, because she said, like many therapists, that bipolar was no use to her as a diagnosis. And I said, but Yasmin, supposing I came to you and I said, I believe that, you know, I'm being watched by MI6, I'm in league with aliens, and I'm due to marry Kylie Minogue. She said, I would say to you that that was a completely normal, in fact, sane reaction to the amount of pressure that you're under, and the little amount that you've slept, and the little amount that you've eaten, and the amounts of cans that you're smoking. I would say that was, she would normalize. So that was the first thing. And then when I confessed about lying, about taking medication, she said, so many people do. And the weight off my shoulders just to know that, I mean, I wasn't alone in it. And I wonder about your experience. So you've taken your as a journalist, but also as an author, you have a public platform. I've come across people like Ahmed Hankir, who's a writer, performer, activist, frontline psychiatrist. He said his patients experience the stigma as worse in some cases than the condition. What is your relationship to stigma? Did you fear it, and have you experienced it?
With treatment, yeah. I think it's easier to talk about depression. I think suicide is one that I can't openly discuss. And that's a main feature of my mental illness is this. I think that in itself is something you don't want to discuss, because people just switch off. You know, they don't want to talk about someone taking their own life. It's just too painful. But I think we do need to normalize that we're having these thoughts. And, you know, for me, you know, having these plans and these, you know, so I nearly took my life in 2017. But because I was open about it with my partner, she actually kind of preempted me. She knew that I was what I had planned, and she'd actually taken action. So I think my approach has always been as open as possible with the people around me. And, you know, that was difficult, like when I first started doing it. Now it's more routine, but I'd say, yeah, suicide is still a very difficult topic to broach, especially with family, because they, you know, it's painful for them to even consider that, but I do it anyway. So they're going to have to, yeah, get used to it. And stigma around treatments, I think, yeah, that's true of all treatments, whether it's psychotherapy. People think that there's still an idea that, you know, you should be able to deal with your own problems without a trained therapist. Although a lot of people, you know, are very open about having a therapist now. And with antidepressants, there's just this, yeah, huge debate of whether they work or not. Or, you know, the recent book by Johan Hari, where he says, you know, if you take an antidepressant, you're a machine with broken parts. It's just that sort of rhetoric that really sort of, yeah, denigrates someone whose experiences that these things have probably saved a lot of lives. They're not, you know, amazing drugs. I think they may work in around 50% of people, whereas the placebo effect can account for about 35 to 40% of that. So, the, you know, the margins are very small. But clinical trials only include a certain patient selection anyway. They don't include people who are suicidal. They don't include people who are very severely depressed, because they can't be part of a trial just because of the... Yeah. Yeah. So you're picking out a very niche group of people, and they're probably, you know, mostly white people if you're kind of talking about people from universities in the West. So yeah, when we have these trials, we're kind of talking about a specific population with major depression. And major depression is a diagnosis that's very strict. You got to have these symptoms for 2 weeks or more. I don't fit that model. Like they don't even mention anxiety. Like, and they don't, and anxiety is core to every, you know, mental illness, but they want to have that as a separate group, as generalized anxiety disorder. So it's another one. And this whole, you know, the DSM, I think psychiatry is moving away from that with different approaches, which is really exciting, because it's, yeah, I think it's stymied the whole like treatment and understanding for 3 decades now.
Yes, I would completely agree with you based on research and anecdotal conversations. So lots of people know this, but some won't. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which was published by the American Psychiatric Association. And it effectively puts psychiatry on a medical white coat prescribing pills footing. And it's underwritten partly by the insurance industry, because the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is a descriptive volume. In other words, it describes categories and then fits you into those categories. That reassures your insurer, who then pays your medication. And it has a horribly unhealthy and long association with the pharmaceutical industry. People who draw up the categories, about 80% of them for DSM-5 had associations with the pharmaceutical industry, very lucrative ones. But it is the most powerful tool of Western psychiatry. In Britain, we use the International Classification of Diseases, but it's just as effectively, it's an intellectual offshoot of the same system. And the problem is, I mean, so the core problem that Heavy Light ends up identifying is that, as Alex has been describing, we suffer as intensely as individuals, but we're sort of ham-fistedly treated as categories. And my contention is that nobody's condition is the same as anyone else's. And I was terrified of stigma. I thought, when I wrote Heavy Light, I'm going to be the writer who went mad and was sent to the loony bin. He's that guy who was crazy. He's crazy. And coming out about being sectioned seemed like a big deal, but my experience has been entirely other. I've never, you know, had more work. People, my students, my university employers, the BBC, seemed completely unbothered by the fact that I had a breakdown. One of my friends said, "HP, you know, we've always known you were crazy," kind of thing, and that's fine. And there was, and is, an honourable place in British society, certainly, and I hope in all, for the eccentric. I mean, the politicisation of the language really got to me. So in the end, I started thinking of it all as degrees of madness. You know, insomnia is definitely a madness. It feels like that, as anybody who's had it will know. Anxiety, depression, all of them, eating disorders, certainly psychosis is your pure, yeah, sort of movie made for the Hollywood madness. And I use it because in a way I, it helps me because I think madness is a part of human life, you know. When we start taking away triggers and looking at influences, and I suppose Alex, that's the thing that makes me feel most pain for you in a way, is that when you say that, you know, for you it's not really identifiable, when these things come in at you, they come in at you out of a clear blue sky. Because I've had long periods, or long but intense periods generally in the winter, of suicidal thoughts. But, you know, seasonal affective disorder is really quite well understood. It's not. Yeah. It's, you know, what I love about this field is where the mysteries aren't. The problem is on the treatment side is that it's a rat's nest. So I've been working with psychiatrists, and they're really in a bad way because they know the DSM is fairly useless in terms of getting outcomes. The system they're in pushes them towards prescription and diagnosis. They watch young people Google themselves, identify with a diagnosis, and then kind of build their lives and mishaps around that diagnosis. And yet they know that, you know, were they able to say, because a psychiatrist is so powerful to the person sitting opposite them, just in terms of influence, you know, I'm telling you, Horatio, you need to go to a museum every week. You need to walk on grass twice a day. You need 3 meals a day. You need to read this book. So there's a wonderful book. It's called Brain Changer, Felice Jacka, from the Food and Mood Centre in Australia. And they've worked out, you know, that really nutrition absolutely can change your, not just your mental balance, but your IQ.
Which is in my book, by the way. I just want to flag that. Felice is an amazing researcher, and her work is...
So guess how long a psychiatrist spends studying nutrition in the course of their medical degree?
A module.
One afternoon, according to the psychiatrist that I talked to. So not even a module.
And on your point of, you know, stigma and psychosis, I think, and this may be wrong, but I think you're in some way privileged that yours is so discreet that you know it's related to cannabis and this sort of stress, and then, you know, you can avoid those things or cannabis. I'm just thinking of psychosis when we start talking about schizophrenia, and with my cousin who had it, started when he was about 17, starts hearing voices, thinks he's God. I think he thought he was Zeus first, and then he became Jesus Christ, and, you know, everyone was below him, and he became aggressive sometimes. But what I can add to this discussion is the stigma is still there for schizophrenia and chronic psychosis. But I think books like yours can provide an insight that there is a spectrum there, that everyday people can often have psychotic experiences, whether it's drug-related or otherwise. And what's exciting about psychiatry right now is this, in terms of schizophrenia and psychosis, is this appreciation of just how important that first episode is. So when someone starts hearing voices or has paranoia, there's a lot of adolescent sort of care going on now, especially in Australia and Ireland, and some fantastic sort of centres where adolescents can go to, and those voices can be, you know, rationalised or even just listened to, rather than just trying to block them and shut them away. Because I think of my cousin and his trajectory and being institutionalised for so long. What if we had a psychiatry that appreciates that people hear voices, and it's not a psychosis, it's not always something that needs to be just trodden down with antipsychotics? And that's what gives me hope in this field, is that model for early intervention is now spreading to bipolar, to depression, to anxiety. So really focusing on adolescents, when I think it's like 75% of mental illness in adults started before the age of 25, your brain doesn't stop developing until you're 25-30. So, and we're pumping these, historically pumping these people with medications that might change their brain structure. And just because, you know, they're different, you know, my cousin would be, considered mad. And his view of the world is completely against what other people will experience. But what he liked best was walking for miles and miles and miles and listening to his own voices. And, you know, and then he was shut away in an institution and he couldn't leave his cell. And this is, you know, unfortunately common practice. So I think when we talk about stigma, it's worthwhile just, you know, schizophrenia and people, when we kind of think about people on the street who might be, you know, talking to themselves, we still have that stigma as that's someone who's different from me. Whereas I think we're all part of this, you know, this mental illness. It's just we've been shaped down different paths.
Hear, hear. I also think that, you know, it's that walk in my shoes, isn't it? I don't think anybody would have not had some sort of breakdown if they'd done exactly what I'd done for the 2 months running up to the breakdown. But, you know, just due to, you know, inputs, lack of sleep, the psychological pressures and things.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Season 3 of No Bullshit Leadership, brought to you by Intelligence Squared in partnership with Havas Creative, is out now. In this straight-talking podcast, Chris Hurst, Global CEO of Havas Creative, is joined each week by a leader from the world of business, sport, politics, or culture. We've had some wonderful guests on Season 3, including former White House Director of Communications, Anthony Scaramucci, the editor of the Financial Times, Rula Khalaf, and the entrepreneur, Sharmadeen Reed. Search No Bullshit Leadership wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of Season 3 now, and subscribe to make sure you don't miss out on Season 4.
Hello. So I was going to put to you some of the questions that have arrived in the chat. Here's one. Yeah. It's from Paolo, and he asks, what do you think of the theory that depression can be identified or linked to inflammation of the body?
Yes, so I spend a good chunk of the book on that. I think it's pretty confident that I think around a third or a quarter of depressions can be linked to like inflammatory syndrome or some sort of inflammation in the body. And so there's some interesting trials going on now to find out if anti-inflammatories might work. But what we do know, if you do decrease inflammation in the body, that not only helps people into remission from depression just without anything else, it also makes other treatments more effective. So inflammation in the body can block antidepressants from working. And if you can reduce it with through exercise or through diet, then you can even make the treatments we already have more effective. So I think inflammation is really key to understanding where depression might come from for a large part of the population, and also how we might be able to treat it and make it more treatable for other with other treatments that we have. So yeah, and there's some really interesting historical parts of the book where if you give people pro-inflammatories for cancer, so this is what happened in the 1980s, I think I mentioned in Finland, they started to realize that a lot of these patients developed a mirror or the exact same sort of copy as depression. They were just given these very high pro-inflammatory drugs to wipe out the cancer. But a large percentage of them, I think about 80%, developed what would be considered clinical depression. And that then kind of tagged people onto maybe this is related, that if we increase inflammation, people become depressed. And yeah, I think it's a really fascinating and hopeful part of where psychiatry might be going. And all, I think inflammation is linked to everything. Like, it's not just depression. It's just, it really is central to how we understand health.
This is potentially the most radical turning point in treatment for a long time, isn't it? If they get a handle on it, because just in terms of the numbers that you're talking about, the percentages in which it might play a role or does play a role.
Yeah. And, you know, we all live quite unhealthy lives. Like, we're not especially in the UK and the US, it's the, you know, high rates of obesity and sedentary lifestyles. You know, I sit at a desk all day and type and probably don't get enough exercise or sunlight. And so I think inflammation, if we can find a way to sort of reduce that, I think it's beneficial for a lot of different health systems.
Thank you so much for that question, Paolo, for that wonderful answer, Alex. Sarah very kindly says, do you think antidepressants are overprescribed in our society? And if so, what would the alternative be given the financial pressures on the NHS?
Like I said, yeah, I think they are overprescribed, but I think what I like to think of it is they're probably prescribed to the wrong people. So I think a lot of the people who are depressed don't reach out for help and they're not getting the prescriptions. But then the people who do reach out for help probably didn't need antidepressants. So I think overprescribed might be, a confusing term. But like I said earlier, I think I'm concerned that they're being given to people who would benefit from other options. But that the cost of giving people access to exercise or access to healthy food is obviously much harder than giving them a pill that's run through its patent and the pharmaceutical companies can just churn them out for nothing. So what I'd like to see is more investment in these alternative approaches in mental health care, because we still spend very little on mental health, even though they're such a big driver for not only morbidity from poor mental health, but also they make every other sort of disease, physical disease, worse. So they are related to cardiovascular disease, related to sort of dementia. So I think we need to increase how much we invest in our mental health. And if that's something that we can do, I would look into more holistic approaches, exercise, changing people's diets, and so even like prescribing a personal trainer or more like activities that get people out of the house and rather than just giving them pills. But that is hugely idealistic. And it's just...
Yes, I think there is a role for radical idealism. So Calderdale, in the second half of the book, I interview the people who section me and my nurses, all the way up to chief executive of Calderdale NHS Trust, and then of Calderdale Council, and then all the way to the local MP. And what I would say about this is clearly they are overprescribed. I mean, the NICE, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence guidelines say you should not be offered, no one should be offered antidepressants without therapy. Now, clearly we don't have the number of therapists that that would require. So we should be aware that we're already in breach of our own guidelines. Young people of my acquaintance and students are offered antidepressants at the drop of a hat.
I was offered it to butt in. I was offered citalopram before anything. And I refused it. Only later did I sort of go, as I write in the book, I go on to antidepressants, which was the right thing to do. But to be offered it immediately just seems so wrong.
Radical treatments. I mean, so in Grenoble, in southeastern France, they removed all advertising from the entire city. Even if you owned a shop, you couldn't have an advert in the window bigger than a piece of A4. And they did it on the grounds of child mental health. And it's fascinating when you go, because at first you can't work out why the whole place seems so calm and chilled and what we'd call mentally healthy. And it's because you're not being bombarded, lied to and manipulated from, you know, every commercial surface. So when you think then, you know, mobile phone use, the way in which the internet is effectively like a weaponized version of the old Daily Mail, which is supposed to leave you angry and confused, those things clearly aren't helping. It really worries me that we give away antidepressants because we've put the money there rather than in taking the time for a clinician to say, right, let's just run through your life circumstances. So your girlfriend dropped you, your parents aren't happy, you're living at home, you haven't got any money and you're finding school really hard. So is there something wrong with you that, you know, that, or is it a disease that we need to treat medication, or are these life circumstances that would make anybody miserable? And what can we do to address them? Which is where we get to you with social prescribing. There clearly is a huge problem there, but I do think it's better understood thanks to people like you, Alex, and to people sharing and realizing that, I mean, my contention really is that, you know, in a lot of cases, as I think you're outlining, medication is prescribed to treat symptoms, but the causes are left unaddressed. So that, those were the thoughts that I would offer on this. Michaela asks if we think depression is a disease of modernity or if it's always existed. I mean, clearly your book is a refutation of the idea that it's a disease of modernity. But I would ask, Alex, do you think that we're suffering in certain kind of era-specific, cultural-specific ways at the moment? And I'd link this to a question about the lockdown and what happened to people. James asks, what about your own and the mental health of others during lockdown?
That's a good question about whether it's changed culturally through time. It's kind of wrapping two elements of the book together. I think this would be more pure speculation than anything, but I think depression as we understand it today, and it's more of an anxiety disorder largely, which is why a lot of the drugs for anxiety work with depression. So SSRIs and minor tranquilizers. I think that's the sort of syndrome of modernity, where we have an anxiety that becomes a sense of hopelessness, and that sense of hopelessness becomes the sort of black of depression, where, you know, you lose all motivation. So I think that would be the most common sort of experience for depression today. Whereas looking back historically, if we go back, you know, centuries or even millennia to, you know, where it was melancholia, I think that we're talking about a very severe form of depression that was probably leading people to be institutionalized or to be abandoned by their families or hidden away or, you know, chained or anything like that. I think melancholia was seen as quite a severe, almost like a madness state that was, a few people would really sort of sympathize or be able to kind of see themselves in those shoes. So I think, we've always had depression, but I think the term depression has changed a lot over history. And today, depression can mean anything. It can mean anything from, you know, very minor sort of low mood to people who are catatonic in psychiatric wards and given ECT because nothing else has worked. And then you go into like psychotic depression, which is, you know, something that responds very well to ECT. And these delusions are almost sort of the same as, you know, your manic version, but, you know, with a depressive tinge of, you know, their bodies are rotten, they've sinned and they've kind of committed this horrendous crime, whereas none of them, they haven't done anything. They've just, you know, have very severe depression. So yeah, it's a term that can be used for anything. It's kind of like a wastebasket of psychiatry, I think, which is unfortunate because a lot of people kind of label themselves to be, to have depression to then get help. But I don't think that's often the best way to frame how they experience mental illness.
So, yes, exactly. It's interesting, isn't it, in different cultures. So I was told a story recently of a man from West Africa who was a revered figure in his community and met a traveling British woman and moved back to Britain and was quite soon after that banged up, and he was given a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And the fact was that he heard voices, but in his community and in his setting, that was a thing which people admired and was given space, like your dear cousin, the idea of him walking, like he'd actually found his therapy, hadn't he, before they... and so the cultural context just changes. And it also made me think of, I was teaching at a university in the Northwest a few years ago, and we had a wave of anxiety among the students. And it, when we sort of looked hard at it, a lot of it was to do with the fact that they saw the modern life as a kind of glass cliff, with them at the bottom and their chances, their life chance at the bottom, and everybody else, you know, from their tutors onwards at the top. And they talked about letting down their parents because they couldn't see them doing as well as their parents had done, you know. And it made me think that we can, you know, what a good life is and what value is and what meaning is also needs to be reconfigured because none of it makes sense. And so that, my experience of lockdown was that I spent much more time with my wonderful family, and I was very lucky because we live in the Yorkshire Moors, so it was great. But I spent lots of time thinking about blessings. I'm a great one for not counting my blessings when I'm happy in the summer and just running forward looking for more of them, like a kind of mad hungry ghost, as Tibetan Buddhism would put it. But instead I couldn't travel as a travel writer, so I sat and thought about the places that I'd been, and it was a rich and wonderful experience of that, you know, realization of good fortune. And my other experience of lockdown was that people I would never have expected to talk about their mental health started talking about it. So people at the BBC, my former bosses, very successful dear friends, would suddenly use the phrase "my mental health," and you'd think, God, I had no idea you had any concept that that was something, you know. And I, the only thing I worry about with that is that it may be niche. You know, so the other really hard line in my book is obviously I'm middle class, articulate, used to dealing with the police and with authority as a journalist. I welcome it. I'm not scared of them at all. And so Rebecca, who's very well connected because her sister's high up in the NHS, they really struggled to get me the treatment that I needed. And when I interviewed the chief executive of the clinical commissioning group, he said when he started, there were about 25 pathways to care. And there are now 2,500. They're thinking about employing people to help people navigate the different pathways. So what I would say to anybody who is in trouble or knows people who are, is that you need to shout and make a fuss, because the resources are there. It's just that they're disproportionately accessed by people like us, I suspect. And so you're much more likely to end up in A&E, and you're much more likely to be sectioned if you're poor, not white, not privileged, and not a great communicator. And that's just the way it is. And it's a scandal and a shame on our society. But and the NHS hates it and regrets it. But the fact is, you need to shout. And the other thing I would say would be, you know, if you know someone who is in trouble, like you know, Alex, if were you to get in that position, your partner is exactly right. You know, sectioning for me was one of the best things that ever happened to me. It made me change the way, because I'd sort of skated along like, you know, my mental illness was a wave that was always chasing me that would sometimes catch me. But actually, when it really catches you, I mean, I woke up one morning and I said out loud, right, okay, you're in a mental hospital in Wakefield under Section 2. And that was a real change of life, at the beginning of a change of life. And the other thing that really helped me was I went to this wonderful woman, Yasmin, who runs Open Dialogue. Open Dialogue has stunning effects. It basically talks not just your problems out, but what you're going through with your network. So your partner, your family, the people you live with, your closest friend, your whatever, a peer supporter who's been there before, like somebody like me who's been sectioned, say, and an Open Dialogue practitioner. And particularly with first episode psychosis and schizophrenia, they have stunning results. It's a life changer, and it is growing. But I said, Yasmin, the fact is I've Googled the hell out of this. You know, the BBC trained me to Google and to read. I looked at all the research papers. There's no cure. And she said, no, there isn't a cure. It's about healing. And that has really helped me. It's been the even more helpful than therapy was this conception that, you know, it's a rough road and it's a journey. But as a travel writer, I can understand that. I understand that journeys have reversals and that things go horribly wrong. But, you know, the idea of progress in it and hope in it are the main things. And Alex, you've clearly found methods to hope for yourself. I wonder, with your experiences, when you face the future, and I'd like to know about your next book, how do you see it? Is it a fearful place? Do you expect things to come that you can't cope with, or do you think that you have enough knowledge and tools and help and support?
I mean, being a depressive is kind of having a split personality. So you'd ask me one day, today I'm feeling a bit brighter and I think that there is hope. Another day I'd say that there's no point in doing anything and, you know, complete despair. And I'd rather not be here. But today I can say that, yeah, I think, you know, I wrote a book about depression while being depressed for, you know, months in between. I think that's something that provides me with some, you know, hope that this isn't something that's completely going to debilitate. With the help of psychotherapy and different sort of elements of my life that I changed, a loving partner and, you know, medication, that I did produce this thing over 4 years, it has to be said, but still. And the future for me is, yeah, just continue to maybe write in this field. And yeah, I think I also need to go back to the lockdown question because I didn't answer that. But we had our first child during lockdown. So it's been a very niche experience. And it was very lovely, even though I haven't been completely stable. Having a baby around for lockdown was just incredible. Now she's 18 months and walking around and talking and shouting at me. So it's a bit less peaceful. But yeah, it was the isolation of lockdown has been really difficult. And I think that now we're beginning to open up, I think, and we can reconnect and talk about our mental health, like you say, with people that we never even thought about, that I think that's a real beautiful thing, that we can start to reconnect and to sort of build up, knowing what we do now about the importance of connection and doing things that we used to do and really just, you know, taking stock of things that really matter to us. So yeah, I'm currently researching a book into kind of like the sequel to this one, where this was treatments for depression over time. I really want to focus on this kind of core period of adolescence and childhood of, you know, where do these mental illnesses take root? And rather than focusing on the sort of like the dire, like adolescents are more depressed than they've ever been and they're more anxious than they've ever been, actually focus on what can be done. So, you know, for my own experience, you know, what happened with me and depression, my cousin with schizophrenia, my other family members with alcohol, like this is a core period of our lives where these things can take effect and sort of affect our adulthood throughout our lives. So I'm kind of, yeah, researching the different interventions that can be so key to kind of taking people away from what could become a chronic and debilitating mental illness and directing it towards something that is more, yeah, like you say, healing and healthful.
Wonderful. Well, we're extremely lucky to have a writer of your quality and also of your courage, not just to go into these places, but to share them and to take us there for all of our benefit and enlightenment. I wish you that huge good luck with your next book. It will be another cracker. The current cracker is A Cure for Darkness, and mine is Heavy Light. I've been Horatio Clare, and that was Alex Riley. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you
for your time and attention.